Hello and welcome to Newspeak. I'm Peter Whittle, joined as usual by Rafe Hadelman QR Senior Fellow and Royal Historian, and Amy Gallagher, who is the STP's candidate for the London Mayoralty and the woman behind Stand Up to Woke, which is also the name of your campaign. Is that right? Before we talk about the week's events, a few notices here about our burgeoning locals network. Many events actually coming up, but I've got some of the highlights here, which are very, very important. Well, first of all, we have tomorrow, actually, in Norwich. Tomorrow in Norwich, that's the 28th of April. There is a meeting of the locals group there, and that's actually going to be with a guest speaker, Alka Segal Cuthbert, from Don't Divide Us. And also tomorrow in Nottingham, we have an event there with the speaker, the economist Catherine McBride, who's quite often on GB News, so you might know her already. So those are two events which are happening tomorrow. And then looking a little bit further afield, on Tuesday the 1st of May, so that's next week, Rafe, you're actually going to be, aren't you, in Liverpool. Rafe here will be in Liverpool at the inaugural event of our locals there. And then in Canterbury on 2nd of May, I will be down there. And that's again another inaugural event. So four events there, tomorrow the 28th, and then of course on the 1st of May. And so basically, and the 2nd of May, any of those, do write in if you want to know the details of where they are and when. They're all free as well, by the way. These are proving very, very popular, so do come along. Please write to locals at newcultureforum.org.uk, and that's the way to find out where you should go. Before I talk about the week's events, just wanted to let people know we had a very successful conference, didn't we, last week?
Yeah, it was good. Yeah,
our fourth national one. Any observations or about it particularly?
Just what was most notable was how quickly we sold out. Yeah. We sold out well in a month in advance.
Tickets, that is, by the way. Not intellectually.
No. Heaven forbid. But that was so encouraging to see that there was so... And we're sorry for those of you who weren't able to get tickets. We know that you're going to be disappointed by that, but we will have videos of these speeches coming out soon. And the energy in the atmosphere was so positive, and everybody was so receptive, and such kind comments, you know. Thank you for all of those kind comments, which we all received, and really make what we do worthwhile when we hear those sorts of remarks. And it was lovely also on this occasion to have Amy there as the SDP candidate, speaking along with Lawrence Fox from Reclaim and Howard Cox from Reform. So we were able to actually give people an option of you know, if you're on the centre-right, these are the policies could be properly investigated in terms of the London local election. So that was a nice novel addition.
It was actually, in fact, I should actually add, Susan Hall from the Tories was invited her. I've kind of known Susan from way back in the Assembly, but she had a prior engagement.
Yes. You know,
very silly to miss that. I mean, I've even asked her on this show, actually, and she declines. Don't quite know why, but anyway, that was great. I must add, actually, before you add your two pence worth, locals. You know, I was just going through those notices. We had locals speaking for the first time. Stephen Balog, the organizer, just gave it all context. But we had four people. There was Chris, Roland, Dean and Sheila, and they weren't just talking about how they set up branches, they were talking about things that they were passionate about, why they were involved with the NCF, and I wanted to do a lot more of that. It went down very well.
It was a great day. I mean, there was lots of enthusiasm from the audience. Most people stayed to the whole end of the day.
Yeah, they did, didn't they?
Which was good. All the speakers were brilliant. David Starkey was a highlight for me, but everybody was really good, and it was quite a positive day, considering some of the topics we're talking about. It did seem positive, so that was good.
Yes. Actually, Starkey was quite brilliant, wasn't he? Well, we're all brilliant. You were brilliant. You were brilliant. I thought that the standard was excellent. Anyway, it was, in fact, officially our St. George's Day conference. St. George's Day obviously fell on the Tuesday, and almost as predictably as night follows day, there were kind of, there was a St. George's March, wasn't there, in Whitehall. But it brought up again this issue we've discussed about two-tier policing. I don't know, Rafe, what you thought of this, but it seemed to me to be utterly blatant that compared to the way in which the police are now, you know, not enforcing the law, if you like, when it comes to the Palestinian demonstrations, they seem to absolutely go heavy-handed into this one.
Oh, it was a blatant example of two-tier policing. I mean, you know, you can just compare and contrast the policing of the two events, a world of difference. Now, it has to be said, you know, I mean, I wasn't there, so I don't know all exactly what happened, but the distinction between the two events is that the Palestinians have their march through London, whereas this protest was a cordoned off section of Whitehall, where the outside Downing Street, that's frequently where you will get people who are protesting will be put into this area. But, you know, when you have a group like that of patriotic English people gathering together with a few lively spirits, you know full well that they will want to inevitably march up to Trafalgar Square, where Nelson's Column is. It's just inevitable. So why were the police so heavy-handed? You know, they should. It was a failure of policing not to realise, look, let's just let them go on their way. Yeah, you know, why on earth don't if you cordon a group like that in, you're going to naturally get. So that I think the police actually encouraged that, or set the foundations for that sort of a confrontation. And so that was a great failure of policing. And I just thought to myself, you know, the way that the police were dressed was noticeably different, more in riot gear compared to what you get for just a couple of hundred people. You know, we're not talking about a vast number. And again, it just goes to show, as we saw with that, you know, that Gideon Falter from the Campaign for Anti-Semitism being stopped for being openly Jewish, it seems as if they're doing everything they can to avoid offending the Muslim population of London and the pro-Palestinian side. So anybody who might possibly have views that run contrary to that, you must come down with the full force of the law. And it's so obvious to people, and it's just further eroding trust in the institution.
There was no need really for horses to go in, was there, Amy?
No, it's ridiculous. I mean, the police actually raised a Section 60, which is like an act which means that they can increase stop and search powers. And this was done preemptively, you know, anticipating a so-called far-right protest, but it was nothing of the kind. I mean, the group there was singing Sweet Caroline, a song by Neil Diamond, just like a song about romance. They weren't targeting a particular group. There was no anti-Semitic chants. There was no violence. There was no swastikas, as we've seen in the pro-Palestinian marches, hate marches, which I would call them. And I don't even understand why they're even being called far right. It seems to me to be a group of people who are promoting English or British values and celebrating St. George's Day, a Christian patron saint. And it's unbelievable that this, you know, that the pro-Palestinian marches, which are, oh, I would say, more far right than the actual so-called far right British marches, are not being policed. So it's absolutely complete two-tier policing. I suspect it's because the police know that they can get away with it. They know that they'll have the media on their side. They know that they won't be accused of being racists. And also, as Ray said, the group is so small that they probably feel confident enough to deal with them. Mm. What we've seen with the pro-Palestinian marches is that they are so large that the police almost sort of give up. There's so much extremism. There's promotion of terrorist organisations. You didn't see that in the St. George's Day marches. They weren't saying, you know, they weren't promoting Hamas or any other extremist organisation. Mm. And it's almost like the police just give up. I don't know. Or they actually actively do, you know, support the pro-Palestinian marches, who knows? But it was just a blatant expression of two-tier policing. And the fact that they were on pleases and charging into groups of people who were just doing nothing. They weren't jumping on monuments or doing graffiti or waving, you know, anti-Semitic messaging or anything like that. And it seemed to me to be actually kind of almost propaganda in the making, in that when you see police charging towards a group on horses, you assume that, well, that group must be doing something wrong. And that's how it's being presented in the media. But I can't see as to what it was that they were doing wrong. They weren't being violent or antisocial in any way. So
what was interesting about this as well, I thought, was that the Met put out a statement in the morning saying there is going to be a march, and we are expecting far right groups. We will do all that we can in our power to avoid incident, whatever, something. But whenever they put out incident, preemptive statements about these Palestinian marches, they never mention there will be extremist elements. Never.
No. And you're precisely right. They never say they're going to be Islamists present there. Yeah. They're going to be supporters of terrorism who are there. And this mythical far right, I mean, the thing that was so depressing yesterday, not just in relation to this event, but all the coverage of St. George's Day, I did, three debates, I know you did one on it too, is how the far right have hijacked English nationalism. I'm sorry, that group yesterday, to my mind, far right nationalists are neo-Nazis, skinheads, who are Sieg Heiling, wearing black boots with white laces and so forth. We know what the far right is. Mm. None of that was on display yesterday. This huge myth, everyone talks about the far right as if they're an equivalent to the Islamists. I mean, they're a tiny, insignificant group, and ordinary, decent folk, like we saw yesterday, are being tarred with this brush. I mean, everybody now who's to the right of Caroline Lucas is far right, as far as the police and the media are concerned. And you're quite right. What happened here was that the police set the narrative of a far right group coming, and then, of course, they actually set the groundwork for a confrontation. The confrontation happened, and the media leapt on it. And the average British person who hasn't got the time to investigate these things sees those angry scenes, sees the St. George's flag as draped over people's shoulders, and draws the inevitable conclusion that there is a problem here with the far right. I'm sorry, there's an Islamist mountain and there's a far right molehill. The two are completely opposite, and we didn't see the far right on display yesterday. And it's a great shame that once again the decent majority of this population are being tarnished and having their reputations traduced like this.
Yeah. You said decent people. I'd add to that decent on the whole working class people, working class guys mostly. And that, of course, is absolutely anathema to your average commentator. Mm. There's an old saying, when your average liberal sees a group of youngish white men together, they immediately think fascist, right? And I remember when all this, there was a problem with the statues, Churchill was being attacked in 2020. Again, the mayor said, far right groups are coming, before anyone had turned up. So, as you say, and then of course, you'd see a lot of guys, many of them maybe bald, and all of that, and it plays right into this. And then you have people like Tom Tugendhat, or whatever his name is, saying, these are just thugs,
It's an absolute hatred for the white working class, particularly men, isn't it? We saw it on our Mistress Day. There was like a group of men congregating around the cenotaph, and they were immediately targeted by police, and they weren't doing anything wrong. And even in the statement that you said from the Met Police, they said far right protests and football fans, as though those two things are basically the same thing. You think, well, hang on, one of those things sounds very, very benign, and one of those things sounds quite extreme and worrying, and you've just lumped them all in. It doesn't seem to me that they're far right at all, but it does seem that the working class men are the one group that is totally acceptable, despite the fact that they are underprivileged, they genuinely are marginalised educationally and socioeconomically. That is the group that you can target and say whatever you like about them.
Mm. Interesting. You mentioned these media debates. It is a bit kind of annoying, isn't it, when they drag on these real provocateurs, people. I don't know. I was on with this guy. He's often on
Femi Nylander.
GB News, yeah. And then you were on with a crazy woman.
Iman Asian.
But basically, I think the point was made in these debates. There was a poll done, wasn't there, which showed that something like 3/4 of people had no problem at all with the English flag, thought it wasn't offensive, and it was a nice thing to have representing England. But of course, this is how the media then does make everything, to use that word, binary, doesn't it? It sets up one and one. So we automatically think it's a massive contract, but in fact, there's not. 3/4 of people.
3/4 of people believe there's nothing offensive or racist about the English flag. That works out to 91% of Conservative voters, but only 56% of Labour voters. So there is still a huge issue. The Emily Thornberrys of this world, who again have that elite snobbery, You know, I'm always reminded of, you know, Henry V, you know, the great cry, God for Harry, England and St. George, when Henry V speaks about the yeomen of England being the, you know, being the salt of the earth and being the actual, the true essence of England, none of whom does not have noble lustre in his eyes. And we seem to have lost touch with that, and the disdain we have for the working classes. No surprise, therefore, we have a recruitment crisis in the army. But yes, with all of this stuff that we were taking part in, these debates and so forth, this idea that the right, and forget the far right, that the right have hijacked English nationalism. It isn't that the right have hijacked nationalism, it's that the left hate nationalism. The left have vacated the playing field. They're not actually making a claim to England and Englishness. Now, in the past, people like Tony Benn did. Clement Attlee was very proud to be English. You know, the great sort of folk musician Billy Bragg was all about England. So there is there's enough space to have a left-wing English patriotism as there is for a right-wing English patriotism. But the left are internationalist. They're not nationalist. They hate borders and so forth. And they're ashamed of England. Although I should say they don't mind it when it's Scottish nationalism or Welsh nationalism. But when the Scots and the Welsh wave their flags, it's called progressive nationalism. But when it's done in England with the St. George's flag, it's racist.
I think that the thing behind that surely is that first of all, when they say about hijacking this thing, it's totally disingenuous. It's been hijacked, we've got, you know, you think, yeah, look, you know what, you don't like the flag anyway.
Exactly.
It's not a question of you worrying about it being hijacked. You hate it anyway.
Yeah.
You know, in fact, this is quite convenient if it has been. I don't think it has been hijacked. I think people are not that stupid. They can work out who's using it in a kind of cynical way and who isn't. But one thing I was wondering, I mean, when you were growing up, did you celebrate St. George's Day? Well, I mean, like, say, when you were a kid, do you remember it happening much?
No, I didn't really. No. But I think increasingly in the last few years, it's become more important to me. I think that the story of St. George is amazing. I've got one of Paolo Uccello's paintings of St. George killing the dragon on in my flat. And I think there's been a resurgence into the interest of the story because of Jordan Peterson talking about slaying dragons and just people becoming more interested in conservatism. And I think it's more important than ever because there are lots of dragons around at the moment that need to be slayed. We need people to stand up to. So I think that's why we're seeing these marches, but because these groups know that there's something awry and they know that there's something that needs to be defended. Maybe they don't articulate it in the best way, but they know that there's something that is being lost. And I would like to see more done to celebrate St. George's Day, actually. I wish that I had known about it growing up, and I didn't. And it's something that, as I grow older, it feels more and more important to me, actually.
Well, also, isn't the fact that people should value and do value things when they feel that, A, they're under threat, and B, they're about to lose them?
Well, there is a growing appreciation for St. George's Day. So on my 13th birthday, I asked my parents for a flagpole, and I used to fly the Union flag every...
You are quite entrepreneurial.
Every day. But that's my point. So I would fly the Union flag every day, and then on St. George's Day, I would fly the cross of St. George. Oh. And I was an anomaly. That's my point. Mm. There weren't many people doing that. Mm. But I've been attuned and alert to this ever since then. And I've been interested to see the growing interest in St. George's Day. Just look at the social media posts that were out yesterday for St. George's Day. We're recording this the day after St. George's Day. So heartening to see all of that. And again, you're seeing across this country much more of an effort made to celebrate this. A lot of it is a reaction to devolution, because the English see the Scots and the Welsh being rewarded for their patriotic fervour and for throwing their rattles out of the pram quite often. And they've had huge benefits from devolution and Devo Max given to the Scots and so forth. The English don't have their own parliament. It was very acute during Tony Blair and Gordon Brown's day when you had Labour MPs in Scotland voting on English-only legislation, and it was only those Scottish votes that got it through. So the injustices here rankle hugely. So, you know, in the 1966 World Cup, you had a sea of Union flags there. Now, of course, at England matches, it's a sea of St. George's crosses. And so I think very much there is this reawakening of Englishness, but it needs to go further. But the problem with English identity is that England has offered up all of its achievements to be woven into the British national fabric in a way that you don't see with Scotland. So everything that people here and abroad think about when they think of British is actually Englishness, you know, from Parliament to the monarchy, you know, sport and all the rest of it. And you just have to go into Wikipedia, for example, and look up, for example, someone like James Watt, and he'll be identified as a Scottish inventor and engineer. But then if you look up Isabel Kingdom Brunel, British. So, you know, there's this huge distinction. So I think the English need to reclaim all of those things that they have made into the, they've made British.
Yes, I'd agree. I think it's interesting, this point, you know, about the Union Jack at the 1966 World Cup. I think the watershed moment was in the mid-90s when I think it was the European Championships or whatever, but it was solidly for the first time England flags. I remember that my parents, who were not kind of like political wonks, anything like, but they gradually stopped calling themselves British and started calling themselves English, almost imperceptibly. And I think it's because they felt, look, well, frankly, it looks like anyone can be British, actually. They were thinking of immigration. They weren't thinking of Scotland and they weren't thinking of Wales. They were thinking, how do we hold on to something? Right, so they would have said British, but then they started saying English. I regularly call myself English.
I've never really called myself openly British.
Visibly English.
But that has been the biggest change, because historically, Ulstermen would always say that they're British first, and then the English would say they're British first, but the Scots and the Welsh always said they were Scottish and Welsh first, and now that's changed. I'm sure Ulstermen still say they're British first, but in this country, certainly, more people say they're English than British now.
It should be, don't you think, a bank holiday?
Absolutely.
I'd like to see it as a bank holiday, yeah.
Well, we've got the early May bank holiday, right? So in the past, I've said that should be Churchill Day, May the 10th, when he became Prime Minister, to have an annual Winston Churchill Day. But I'd be quite happy to see it called, you know, St. George's Day as a holiday.
Yes. And also, I mean, you know, look at what we've got on the 23rd. It's the putative birthday of Shakespeare, and indeed when he died. Also, the Queen, the late Queen's birthday was what, just 2 days before. It's very nicely bound up, isn't it? All of it. I mean, it would be a great thing to do. Anyway, let's hope that this, you know, takes, you know, stays with us. This new recognition, despite the efforts of our betters. Speaking of our betters, I'm so interested. Here we are on Saturday. This coming Thursday, May the 2nd, major date for you, my dear. So tell us what's happening on that.
So it's the London it's the London mayoral elections. Yeah. Obviously, I'm on the ballot, which is very strange, but very exciting. It's obviously Sadiq Khan versus Susan Hall, the two main parties. And then there's lots of other independents, and I'm obviously representing the Social Democratic Party. What's it been like? It's been interesting. It's been, it's good. It's good. I've really developed as a person, I think, and the Social Democratic Party are a really great party, and there's lots of, I've met some really intelligent, brilliant people.
Were you active before in it then, or were you just...
A little bit, but not as active, not as I have been now. I'm glad. I'll be glad when it's over, I must say. But it's been good. It's been
I mean, what do you think? I was particularly going to focus actually when we're talking about this, because it's sort of important. I was on the way here today, and I was in the cab, and actually, this same old conversation you're having. The cab driver saying, "Please don't tell me he's going to be in again. Yes. You've got to get rid of him." You know, he said, "Everyone in my cab, no one's voting for him." And I said, "Yeah, but with great respect, the people who are voting for him will not be in your cab."
Yeah, precisely. I think, you know, the reality is, you know, London is essentially a one-party state. That was the whole purpose behind mass immigration. But actually, the last election, the Tories came close to defeating Sadiq Khan when they had Sean Bailey there. And I really regret the fact that ULEZ wasn't an issue at the previous election, because if ULEZ had been an issue at the last election, then I think Sadiq Khan would have been kicked out of office. ULEZ is an issue in this election, but unfortunately the candidate isn't up to the same level. Now, it has to be said, unfortunately, that I think that we are in this situation where, unless you have somebody as charismatic as a Boris Johnson, which is very rare, you would need to have, unfortunately, an ethnic minority candidate to go up against Sadiq Khan. Ideally, you know, someone who's, you know, from an Asian background, or, you know, certainly, or a black background. It's terrible to say that, but we know that 80% of ethnic minorities, and by which I primarily mean black and Muslim, tend to vote for people who resemble them rather than for their actual policies. And so once people understand that, then you realize the sort of politics you need to take, you know, you take account of it in this country. But also, I just think Susan Hall is not a very good candidate.
Actually, before you go on, actually, let's just take a look, actually, because this past week, Susan Hall went up against Sadiq Khan on LBC, and it got kind of quite nasty, actually. Let's just take a look to remind ourselves.
Well, this decision is very serious because it affects me and my personal safety and my family's personal safety.
Did you feel safe in a London run by someone who tweeted and liked those things?
I'm very careful what I say now, and I've thought long and hard about this, Tom. I've fought three council elections. I've fought three parliamentary elections. This is my third mayoral election. The Tory candidate is the most dangerous candidate I've fought against.
Well, I think that's an outrageous comment.
This is quite interesting, isn't it? Because when he says, Sadiq Khan, you are the most dangerous candidate that I've actually faced, I mean, he's always paying her a compliment, isn't he?
Well, it's been done totally in bad faith. It's completely absurd. Even in his expression, he looks like he doesn't believe it. He knows it's stupid. But he is willing to use these manipulative tactics. And I mean, he talks about he feels unsafe around Susan Hall. This is kind of therapy speak. He's evoking all the sort of woke tropes. And unfortunately, you know, Susan Hall didn't do a very good job of defending herself. She should have turned on him and say, well, she should use, you know, as a woman, I feel like you make me feel unsafe. You keep tweeting out trans women or women. And that means that, you know, and I'm a woman, and it shows me that you're trying to undermine the definition of a woman. We've seen more and more crimes against women in London. She should have put him in his place and said, look, you have promoted gender ideology. We've just had the CAS report. Do you accept the findings of the CAS report, a report that has shown that there has been institutional homophobia and sexism and misogyny? And she should have said, look, I've just signed a recent signature of a letter that's being conducted by James Isis that's going to ask for an inquiry from Rishi Sunak into the harms done by gender ideology. She should have said to him, will you sign that? Will you sign for, you know, that pledge? She could have really put him on the spot, because he has absolutely promoted gender ideology and trans stuff, and he's allowed it to run riot across public transport and the police. And she could have put him on the spot about anti-Semitism. She could have said, look, under your London, we've seen, you know, London resembles actually 1930s Germany. We've seen swastikas, we've seen people being told that they look too Jewish. You know, I feel unsafe because of you, Sadiq Khan, and because of your London. But she didn't attack. She just, she went on, you know, she was trying to. I suspect it's because she's worrying about, you know, having to please certain groups, and she can't be seen to go at him. But she needs to put her cards to the mast and say, look, I this is what I'm for and this is what I'm against. But she's trying to please everyone, and in the end she's pleasing no one. And what she does is she allows Sadiq Khan to essentially, it almost felt like bullying to me, to call this woman dangerous and to say she's unsafe. It was actually horrible to watch, and she allowed him to do it.
She made some kind of rookie errors as well, I think. So first of all, she shouldn't be so supplicant to him, as you say. When he was sort of saying, are you going to apologise for supporting Trump? Are you going to apologise for X, Y, and Z? Why didn't she come back and say, how dare you? You know, what have I got to apologise for?
Are you going to apologise for defending Islamist extremists in the past when you were a human rights lawyer? There's a lot of stuff you can know. I mean, there's so many things you can attack Khan on. And you know, I thought he was despicable in this, and she was disappointing. It was just, and you just read, and the air of injured innocence that he had about, oh, your tweets were so bad. I mean, it was such a, you should get a BAFTA for his performance there. Pure politicking, so disingenuous, and she fell for it, hook, line, and sinker. So you need to go on the offense against this man, and you know, there is, with the right candidate, I think Khan could really be threatened, if not toppled. But I don't understand why, of all the potential people, this was the own, this was the best candidate of the bunch. You know, I mean, there was a lot of funny stuff going on with the selection of the Tory party candidate. Paul Scully was supposed to be the original person who was going to get it. He was defenestrated for Susan Hall. But I think there's a huge degree of incompetence in terms of the Tory party and the selection process for Susan Hall. And also, but this, I think this whole LBC interview looked to me like a setup, because the host of this show was also clearly on Sadiq Khan's side. The way that he managed this discussion, the loaded questions, I mean, it should probably go up to Ofcom for an example of a completely biased interview here.
Yes, I can't remember, he's Paul something, I think, he's not. But when I'd not seen him before, when I saw the clip of this, I thought that he was meant to be political, because it was so biased. I thought, it's have
ridiculous.
I got the wrong...
Yeah, when Sadiq Khan said he felt unsafe and that Sadiq and that Susan Hall was dangerous, the interview was almost sort of sympathising with saying, you know, you felt unsafe. If you genuinely felt unsafe, you know, you just thought, what are you doing? Mm. You know, it's Sadiq Khan. As if anybody believes for one second that Susan Hall makes him feel unsafe. It's ridiculous.
Should have said, you know, people feel unsafe on the streets now for fear of getting stabbed. Yeah. People feel unsafe on your tube. You know, people feel unsafe if they're shopkeepers because of all the looting that's going on. I mean, that's the response you would have hoped that she would have made. But
the thing is, though, you see, when when you're in that position where she's in, and to an extent that you've been in as well, actually, is in a way you almost can't fight a critical mass. I mean, I don't mean to be sort of, I don't mean to be defeatist here, but when you feel that, like, the London that you knew is essentially kind of gone, or is going, and all of that. How the hell do you argue that point? Because so many of the reasons it has are actually almost nothing to do, really, in a way, with City Hall. You know, I mean, in the sense that, you know, we're talking about migration.
It's mass migration.
You've made the point before that he can certainly, you know, he can stand up for London and he can advocate for London. But generally speaking, a lot of the things we're talking about, even if City Hall were not there, would be happening.
Yeah, but I mean, there's a reason why the most vocal critics of immigration and all of these policies are Priti Patel and Suella Braverman, right? There's the ethnic minorities feel that they can talk about these things, and white politicians, with very few exceptions, just are too scared to go into that for fear of being branded racist. That's why I think Susan Hall is the wrong candidate, because she should be going strong on all of these points against Khan, calling him, I mean, he was calling her divisive for her policies and tweets. It's like, if anybody was a master of division, it's Sadiq Khan. And she really should have gone to him on all sorts of aspects of immigration and diversity being our greatest strength and all of this, but she just doesn't feel that she can.
The Tories seem to have pretty much given up anywhere in London. That's one of the reasons why these candidates are very lacklustre. You mentioned Paul Scully, but I seem to remember that quite recently on some other issue, he clawed back and apologised. Do you remember this was on some other issue? You sort of, that was, you had an idea of what he would have been like then, actually, apologising all over. I remember when I was standing, we had Zach Goldsmith, I mean, it was just, it was embarrassing. I mean, such a nice guy, but it was embarrassing. You know, he went in, talked about the mayor's supposed extremism, and then basically just sort of came out with this mea culpa in the end, saying, I've spoken to the mayor, and he accepts I'm not racist. And you just sort of, honestly. And that was someone who was a bit of a knight in shining armour, supposedly.
I mean, Susan Hall's mainly run on the ULEZ expansion, which is right too, because a lot of people are unhappy with ULEZ. But she doesn't seem to have promoted anything positive or promoted any kind of values. The thing is with Sadiq Khan, he does bring a kind of narrative that people can believe in. It's not a narrative I subscribe to or I agree with, but he does have a kind of an ethos. Whereas you think with Susan Hall, okay, she's against ULEZ, And she wants to be tough on crime, supposedly. But what does she actually stand for? And we know what she stands for, but she will not say it because she knows it's going to alienate certain voters. But then you're going to end up probably losing and not even having had the platform to say what you really think. Mm. So she may as well have just gone for it and just said, you know, brought up the issues that we talk about on this show.
Mm. So speaking of that, so we will know the result of the mayoralty next Saturday.
On the 4th of May.
4th of May, so it's second. Okay. Well, look, all the best.
Thanks, Lee. Right?
May the 4th be with you.
Yeah, may the 4th be with you. And yeah. We'll have some kind of post-mortem on it or something at some point anyway. But I think that's it for now. Anyway, so in a running stretch, all the very best. Thank you very much, Rafe. And thank you very much, Amy.
Thank you.
And remember all those dates at the beginning, won't you? And we shall see you next time. Thank you. Hello. If you're enjoying the New Culture Forum channel and you believe in our mission, may I invite you to join our membership scheme at the link below or on our website, newcultureforum.org.uk. Our work is more important now than ever, and we have great plans ahead for the future, but we can't do it without your support. From as little as £3 per month, you can help ensure that we continue on our mission. As a member, you'll receive a range of benefits, including access to exclusive content, invitations to our private events, including here at our studios, free copies of our books, and much, much more, including, of course, our famous NCF mug. If you aren't able to become a member, then please help us by clicking this button and subscribing to our channel. It's completely free. Just remember to also click the bell icon so that you can get notifications when we post new videos. Thank you.